In the recent HBO miniseries, The Night Of, viewers soon realized the show focused on the skin condition of John Turturro's attorney almost as much as the actual murder itself.
It's eczema. Dermatologist says keep them aerated, like that's gonna cure anything. I don't know, maybe it helps, I really can't tell. Don't worry about my feet, it's not contagious.
Executive producer and writer Richard Wright would later note that TV critics and fans have, quote, picked up on eczema as a metaphor for the frustrations of finding a solution in the entire judicial system. But what if that same skin condition were not a frustration, but instead the solution to the question of whether Rocky Myers killed Ludie Mae Tucker? And what if that weren't the only reason he should be taken off death row? Welcome to Undisclosed, The State vs. Rocky Myers. This is the third episode in a four-episode series about a 1991 murder in Decatur, Alabama, and a man who sits in death row despite strong evidence that he's an innocent man. This is Colin Miller, an associate dean professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law. Robbie is sick this week, so I'm joined by my co-host Susan Simpson.
Hey, Colin. This is Susan Simpson. I blog at the UFM LL2, and I'm an attorney at Clinton & Peed PLLC in Washington, D.C.
Here's what I love about Simply Safe. These guys obsess over the details. It's why the alarm system is so good. Here's an example. A typical glass break sensor sometimes gets fooled, a false positive. Sounds like dropped plates or a baby crying. Simply Safe didn't want to settle for typical, because really good home security should be really accurate. So they actually constructed a glass break test facility. They ran over 10,000 live glass break simulations, refining their detection technology until it was so accurate it can distinguish a broken plate from a broken window. This is the level of detail Simply Safe puts into everything they do. It sets them apart from other security companies. Simply Safe's system is designed so you'll never notice it, never have to think about it. It's that easy and intuitive. There's no contract. They work hard to earn your business. 24/7 monitoring with police and fire dispatch is just $15 a month. It's the best around-the-clock protection you can find. And now you can order your Simply Safe security system today at simplysafeundisclosed.com. And Simply Safe will also donate one to a family in need. That's simplysafeundisclosed.com. Simplysafeundisclosed.com.
Let's go back to the crime scene that we described in episode one of the series. Both Ludie Mae Tucker and Mamie Dutton said that a man had come to the door with a bloodstained white t-shirt and said he was bleeding to death. The man had a physical altercation with both women, stabbing Tucker four times and Dutton once. The man then forcibly removed a VCR that had been connected to a TV and cable box. The police thereafter took Tucker and Dutton's clothing for testing, searched the crime scene for evidence, and dusted for fingerprints in the places where Tucker and Dutton said the perpetrator had been. The most promising leads were a fingerprint on the glass door from the cabinet where the VCR was taken, and a palm print from the front door that the fingerprint examination request form said was, quote, believed to be the suspect's. So what were the results of the testing of this evidence? Here's Rocky's attorney, Casey Keaton.
No forensic evidence connected Mr. Myers to the crime. Back then, Mr. Myers was under a doctor's care for severe eczema, which caused his very dry skin to readily flake off. So had Mr. Myers been present at Mrs. Tucker's house that evening, his skin condition surely would have indicated it. But police collected no forensic evidence from the crime scene or the victim's clothing that linked anything to Mr. Myers.
That's right. There were no skin cells, hair, or fingerprints at the crime scene that were a match for Rocky Myers, and none of his DNA was found there. But what about the second part of Keaton's statement? Due to Rocky Myers' extreme eczema, what's the likelihood that he would have left behind physical evidence at this crime scene if he'd been there? Well, let's start with the nature of Rocky's eczema at the time of the crime. Here's Rocky describing it at trial.
I was born with eczema. It's a skin disorder. My skin is very dry and it irritates real easy. I'm allergic to a lot of things and I'm allergic to dust. If I sweat too much, it breaks me out. If I rub against something that's dirty, I can't wrestle with somebody that has not showered. I'll break out. We didn't have no money or nothing like that. I got real bad because I moved from New Jersey to down here. My skin was real bad and would flake up like fish scales. Like I got this tight shirt, or I can do like this at the end of the day, and skin would fall onto the floor from my legs and my face. My hair was falling out and everything. I was seeing a doctor, I forgot who he was, but I was getting treatment for it, and it wasn't helping.
Now, of course, you might say that Rocky was exaggerating this condition because he knew at this point that no physical evidence had been found at the scene. But we also have the testimony of the officers who saw his skin condition when they arrested him. Here's Officer Dwight Hale.
Let's talk about that skin condition. He had real bad flaky skin condition, didn't he?
Yes, sir.
In fact, the skin was scaling off his arms, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
And here's Officer John Boyd.
Now, when you first talked with Robin Myers about this case, he indicated to you he had a skin condition which was rather severe.
Yes, he did.
And the skin condition was on his forearms?
It was then.
And you made note of it?
Yes, sir.
And it was something which was quite noticeable?
Yes, sir.
I asked Rocky about the origin of his eczema. Do you know when you were first diagnosed with eczema, how old you were?
I was a baby. I was born with it. I had to, mom said when I was born, I had to stay in the hospital, you know, for a while so they could figure it out and everything. And she used to put little socks on my hands to stop me from scratching, scratching my skin. So I've had it all my life.
I then asked Rocky about the nature of his eczema back in 1991, around the time of the murder.
And my ex-wife can tell you, I can get up out of the bed at that time, and it could be dry skin on the bed, you know. And I never thinking about it now, I'm embarrassed. I'm embarrassed right now thinking about it. But back then, I wasn't embarrassed. It didn't bother me because that was my wife, and she knew my condition and everything like that there, you know. And it was awful back then. It was bad, you know. Living where we lived at, my house where we lived at was messed up. You know, I had to do a lot. One of the reasons why they let us rent the house, I can't remember the rent, but it was so cheap because it was a fixer-upper. And they said, well, if you fix this up, you can live in here, you know, really, really cheap. And so we, you know, I had to take floors up and put windows in, and we had to fight with all kind of bugs and stuff like that there, and that's not good. That was never, ever good for my skin, especially when it's cold.
Right.
You know, it's not good for my skin at all, but yeah, it was around that time, I had a bad eczema flare-up, you know, around that time, and I contribute that to two reasons, my living conditions, and it was freezing outside, it was cold.
So what exactly is eczema? Here's Dr. Theodore First, a pediatrician at Vermont's Children's Hospital.
Eczema is a red, itchy rash made up of tiny little red bumps that sometimes ooze fluid or crust over. It's commonly found in about 10% of infants and young children from 0 to 5. What's interesting is 50% of the time it goes away by adolescence, but 50% of the time goes on to be associated with other allergic illnesses like hay fever and even asthma. That's because eczema is an allergic reaction to something that irritates the skin. It could be pollen or mold, it could be secondhand tobacco smoke, it could be a wool fabric, could even be stress or sweating. Something gets the skin upset and it starts to cause those little red bumps. Now, it turns out that there is no particular test to diagnose eczema except the appearance of the rash and possibly a family history. So where do you find it? Well, you might find it on a baby's cheeks, on their forehead, on their scalp. As kids get older, it shows up on their chest, on their arms and their legs, particularly in the creases of the elbow and behind the knees.
Rocky is one of those people who had eczema that never went away as he got older, and his eczema did indeed spread to his arms. And so, is it at all plausible that a defendant with eczema like Rocky Myers would not leave behind any physical evidence at a crime scene like the one in the Ludie Mae Tucker case? It's a question that a research team from Germany decided to tackle a few years ago. The team did a study and published its findings in an article entitled Good Shedder or Bad Shedder in the International Journal of Legal Medicine. I was able to speak to one of the principal researchers in the study, Dr. Nicole von Werbschwark. I started by asking her why they did the study.
There was always in the forensic field this question about how much DNA you really loose when you touch something, and it's really difficult to do some systematic investigations with this. And so when you check the literature, there were many studies out published showing, okay, it worked, here you can touch something and you can get a genetic fingerprint. There was, of course, also this paper about good and bad shadows. And we had the idea to really try a systematic approach and to check why you are a bad or a good shadow. And of course, it's totally individual specific, but also you have to keep in mind the possible skin conditions such as specific diseases.
Right.
And so we just collected different groups and such like healthy persons with great skin and persons with really, really dry skin, persons with specific diseases, as you can reread in the paper, to see how big the difference really is.
I then asked her about the study itself.
So what we did is what's written in the paper, we had this glass plates where you have to touch the plates to give a full handprint. And then we did real-time PCR to check for the overall human specific DNA. And of course we did the SDR typing. We are as forensic experts, we are sometimes also by court, and the judges, they often ask how likely it is that you really shed your DNA just by touching. And sometimes they are really confused, or they don't believe it when you have a really high amount of DNA from objects that are really only touched. And so this was the background idea to see whether there is a relation to the specific diseases.
It's hard to imagine a better study design for the Rocky Myers case. In the study, the researchers had the study participants hold glass plates. In this case for Rocky, the Decatur police had understandably held a strong belief that a fingerprint on the glass stereo door that housed Ludie Mae Tucker's VCR had been left by her killer. So what were the results of the study? For study participants with normal skin who touched the glass plates, 9% left behind a full DNA profile. For people with skin ulcers that needed treatment, well, 20% left behind a DNA profile. And for those with psoriasis that needed treatment, 64% left behind a DNA profile. So that leaves the study participants with eczema or atopic dermatitis that needed treatment.
That this is the one disease when you shed the most DNA, because then your DNA, your skin is dry, and it's you have this little damages in the skin, and you really lose a lot of cell. You shed a lot, really.
In terms of numbers, 90% of participants with eczema left behind a full DNA profile. And then there's the amount of DNA that was left behind by people with eczema versus those with healthy skin.
And I think the finding that I saw in there was that it's sort of you leave 4 times as much DNA behind when you have atopic dermatitis mm-hmm. as someone with regular skin. Is that correct?
Yeah. And so it's just really, and that's the important thing also, because since this is such a systematic approach, you also have to keep in mind that's a little underestimated, we think, because you know the experimental procedure was to touch the smooth glass plate and to check how much DNA you lose on this plate. In real life, when you touch things and you really touch things differently, you know what I mean.
Uh-huh.
So that then you have much more contact, more impact, and so we think that. Actually, as in real life, when you have such a skin disease, you should lose even more.
Right.
And, of course, this underestimation would seem to be at play in the death of Ludie Mae Tucker, where the perpetrator didn't just touch the glass door, but also had a violent encounter with both Tucker and Mamie Dutton, and also forcefully dislodged the VCR. So, given the nature of the crime in this case, what's the likelihood that Rocky could have been the perpetrator?
In this encounter, the impact with a possible victim when you touch each other, and then you have a, it's not only careful touching, and then you have your clothes and the clothes rubbing over your skin, and all this should definitely lead to the fact that you really lose skin cells.
Right.
And I think it's really peculiar or really strange when what you describe, when you have such a person who really has this skin condition. And as far as I know that, and then we saw that, of course, in the experimental study, but also with colleagues having really bad skin, that they lose DNA all the time.
Finally, as I was ending the conversation with Dr. von Werbschwark, she said the magic words.
My colleague Michaela and I, we also write reports if you need that for the judge or for the court, whatever, so how likely it is and from our point of view. So
okay,
maybe in case you can need that. But sure. I think that's rather strange. So
right.
Usually we have the other way, that people lose so much DNA and we have to explain where they lose everything. And that's pretty easy because they lose so much. But now this is even, your case is really interesting because you have the opposite.
Right. You can bet we'll be following up to get a report on the unlikelihood of Rocky committing this crime. But is there another reason to believe this study actually underestimates the odds that Rocky would have left physical evidence at the crime scene? Late last year, a story quoted Dr. Theodore Rosen of the Baylor College of Medicine as saying, quote, "Atopic dermatitis is an emergency in blacks. Anything you would do in your worst Caucasian eczema patient, do it sooner in African Americans." So what did he mean by that? I reached out to him and he said it meant three things. One is that eczema often leads to irregular and stigmatizing skin pigmentation in African Americans. Another is that comorbidities associated with eczema, like heart attacks and strokes, are more frequently seen in the African American community, where the skin condition often goes undiagnosed for longer periods of time. And then finally, and most importantly, we have this.
This is pretty specific to black individuals as opposed to any skin of color. For reasons that we don't understand, black skin responds to inflammatory processes and injuries, trauma, more readily and more violently, producing a lot of scar tissue. So keloids would be the prototype. But you don't necessarily get keloids from atopic dermatitis, but you do get thickening of the skin. So it feels funny to other people. You know, someone's holding your hand and your hand's all thick and rough. Ugh. And that's more likely to happen in African Americans.
In the story quoting Dr. Rosen, there's a fourth reason given for eczema being an emergency in the African American community. They cite to a study by a team led by Dr. Emma Gutman-Yosky of the Eichen School of Medicine at Mount Sinai Medical Center. As the article notes,
"The researchers discovered that not only is the molecular profile of the skin of people with eczema different compared to those without it, but that African Americans with the disorder show more skin inflammation than European Americans with the condition."
And so, there's every reason to believe that Rocky had more inflammation and skin shedding than the European Americans in the German study. What that means is, it's even less likely that Rocky killed Ludie Mae Tucker.
I am totally guilty of buying way more beauty products than I need, but here's the thing, I don't feel guilty anymore because ever since I started using FabFitFun, I get full size products, like a whole box full of them for just $49.99 a box. It comes to your house four times a year. I love it. I don't celebrate Christmas, but I'm imagining what it feels like four times a year. I love FabFitFun. I have gotten so many products from there. And again, they're full-size products. They are not sample sizes. I have been using probably the same bottles of Ahava moisturizer, face moisturizer cream, foot cream for the last, I don't know, a couple of months, you know? And I just actually finished a product that I never tried before and I loved it. It's by Tarte. And if you know anything about makeup products or any of these cosmetics, Tarte is pricey. Tarte's Drink of H2O Hydrating Moisturizer. It's amazing. And in the summer months, I get really oily, so I want a moisturizer that's kind of clean and light and tart. Drink of H2O was perfect. I just ran out. I literally had to scrape the lid to get like the last few bits off of it. So I'm definitely going to be getting some more of that. By itself, that product alone costs more than the box. You are getting retail value of between $269 to $470. It's kind of crazy. And right now, the 2019 FabFitFun Summer Box is on sale. You got to treat yourself. Believe me, it is so much fun opening those boxes. It also makes a great gift. I have gifted FabFitFun subscriptions for a year to different friends for their birthdays. They just love it. You can do what I do, which is opening it up and seeing what the surprise is, because I love being surprised. Or you can customize your box by choosing some of the products and add-ons with every box. I can't wait to get my next box, so check out how much fun it is by signing up for FabFitFun today. These boxes, by the way, they always sell out. Use our code UNDISCLOSED to get $10 off your first box. Go to FabFitFun.com to sign up and start getting the box for a life well lived. Once again, use the promo code UNDISCLOSED to get $10 off your first box. That's over $200 of the products for only $39.99. Once again, FabFitFun.com, and use our code UNDISCLOSED and get $10 off your first FabFitFun box.
There's another reason that we should have significant doubts about whether Rocky Myers killed Louie Mae Tucker. And it takes us back to episode one and the concept of residual doubt. That gap between reasonable doubt and no doubt. After the recent exoneration of Charles Ray Finch, whose case we covered on a bonus episode of this podcast, there have been 166 death row exonerations in this country. The state with the most death row exonerations is Florida, which used to allow for both, one, non-unanimous jury death votes, where, say, you have an 11-1 or 10-2 jury vote that leads to a death sentence. And two, judicial override, which where you have, say, a judge who overrides a 10-2 or 9-3 jury vote in favor of a life sentence and instead imposes a death sentence. It's perhaps unsurprising, then, that Florida has the most death row exonerations, 29 in total. And as we told you in episode one, Robert Dunham and his team at the Death Penalty Information Center were able to get the jury votes in 22 of those cases. Again, here were their findings about those cases.
In 20 of those 22, there were non-unanimous jury votes for death, either judicial override or a majority but not unanimous jury recommending the death penalty.
That's right. 20 out of the 22 death row exonerations, or 91%, were either cases of non-unanimous jury votes or judicial override. Now, it might not technically be correct to call what was done in Florida a judicial override, because Florida explicitly deemed the jury's vote advisory, with the judge then having the final say in the sentence. And in its 2015 opinion in Hearst versus Florida, the United States Supreme Court declared this scheme unconstitutional. Here's Justice Sotomayor announcing the court's opinion.
Hertz's death sentence violates the Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial. This right requires a jury, not just a judge, to find any fact beyond a reasonable doubt if it exposes the defendant to additional punishment. In Hertz's case, the maximum punishment he could have received on the basis of the first jury's verdict and second jury's recommendation was life imprisonment. Florida law unconstitutionally allowed a judge to enhance Hearst's sentence by finding the critical facts missing from the jury verdicts.
This meant that Florida couldn't use its version of judicial override going forward. But what about inmates who'd already been given death sentences under judicial override procedures? Again, here's Robert Dunham.
In Florida, it was statutorily eliminated. The judicial override was statutorily eliminated, and the non-unanimous jury verdict was declared unconstitutional and then statutorily eliminated. The Florida Supreme Court decided that the unconstitutionality of non-unanimous juries became clear in 2002 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in a case called Ring versus Arizona that there is a right to a jury determination of every fact necessary to impose a death penalty. And when there's a right to a jury determination, that has always been considered a unanimous finding by juries. So the Florida Supreme Court has said that cases that became final prior to 2002, you can go ahead and execute prosecute the defendant. The cases after 2002, they're granted new penalty phase hearings, new sentencing hearings.
So what's this all mean? It means that going forward, a defendant in Florida can only get a death sentence if all 12 jurors vote for the death penalty. And it means that only 5 men remain on Florida's death row, based on either a judicial override or a non-unanimous jury verdict. One of those men is Tommy Ziegler, whose attempts to get DNA testing in his case were recently covered in a series by the Tampa Bay Times. Here's a clip of Ziegler from that coverage.
A friend sent me a copy of an article from the Orlando Sentinel newspaper. It was on Lawson Lamar, the then state attorney, using DNA to convict the first man in the United States of America with DNA. I read that article, made myself a cup of coffee, and I read that article again. Read that article the third time. I said, okay, if they can convict this man using DNA, they can clear me using DNA. And I sit down and I wrote Terry Hadley and Vernon Davis' letter. I told them what I wanted, that I wanted DNA. And I wanted to become a damn expert on DNA. I wanted everything that had ever been published on DNA sent to me immediately.
Ziegler still hasn't gotten that testing, and the state of Florida has denied death row prisoners access to DNA testing 70 times, including for 8 men who have been executed, and including for a handful who are given non-unanimous death sentences. This might explain why Delaware, another state that had judicial override, made a different decision in the wake of the Hearst decision. Again, here's Robert Dunham.
In Delaware, the Delaware Supreme Court declared their statute unconstitutional, applied that to everybody on death row, and cleared the row.
Finally, let's turn to Alabama, which was the third and final state to allow for judicial override. Like Florida, Alabama allowed for both non-unanimous jury death votes and judicial override. The latter is what happened in Rocky's case. Here's Rocky's attorney, Casey Keaton.
The jury recommended 9-3 that Mr. Myers be sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. However, the judge overrode the jury's recommendation and sentenced Mr. Myers to death.
Now, at this point, you might be wondering whether judicial override ever worked the other way, with a judge overruling a jury's recommendation of death and instead imposing a life sentence. The answer is that it could, and this was actually the initial purpose of judicial override. Again, here's Robert Dunham.
The theory behind judicial override was that it was going to provide an additional layer of accuracy and protection, but that's not the way it worked out in any of the states that had it.
Simply put, the numbers in Alabama are stark. In 9 cases, the judge overrode a jury's recommendation of a death sentence and imposed a life sentence. Meanwhile, in 93 cases, the judge overrode a jury's life sentence recommendation and instead imposed a death sentence. So what accounts for this disparity? Well, first, we have the races of the defendants and their victims.
And almost always, the overrides were in cases in which there were African-American defendants, typically in cases in which there were African-American defendants and white victims.
Dunham is citing an Equal Justice Initiative report which found that more than half the judicial overrides of life sentences in Alabama were cases with African-American defendants, despite the fact that African-Americans only make up 26% of the population in Alabama. Moreover, that same study found that 75% of judicial overrides of life sentences were cases of white victims, despite only 35% of all homicide victims in Alabama being white. So for Rocky Myers, an African-American man convicted of killing a white woman, these were strikes 1 and 2. As for strike 3, we have the fact that judges in Alabama are elected.
And what we saw over and over again was that these elected judges would increase the number of overrides in election years, in years that they were up for retention or when they had contested elections.
Dunham is again referencing the Equal Justice Initiative study, which found that judicial overrides to death sentences spiked in election years, with judges presumably trying to show the public that they were tough on crime. For example, in the election year of 2008, 30% of new death sentences were imposed by judicial override, compared to 7% in 1997, a non-election year. And guess what? The judge who overrode the jury's life sentence in Rocky's case and imposed death sentence instead, he was up for re-election. But according to one of Rocky's trial attorneys, the fact it was an election year might not have even mattered.
That case was tried before a judge who gave the death penalty in every capital case, no matter what the recommendation of the jury. He gave death in every capital case, without exception.
Right.
I remember trying the case with a co-counsel, State of Alabama versus Roy Burgess. I had that overturned on appeal. He was able to get his death sentence reversed, and he was a 9-3 for life vote because he was only 16 when it happened. This was, you know, pre the Missouri case.
Right.
My co-counsel, when the judge overrode the verdict of the jury in State of Alabama versus Roy Burgess, my co-counsel ran down the hall to the men's room and vomited.
Now, Burgess did have his death sentence thrown out, but he was not declared innocent. And that may leave you wondering how many death row exonerations in Alabama were the result of unanimous jury death votes. The answer? Zero. There have been 6 death row exonerations in Alabama. One exoneree was Gary Drinkard, who waived a jury vote because he was afraid they'd vote for a life sentence and he wanted a death sentence, which would allow for appointed counsel on appeal. A wager that somehow paid off. And then we have the 5 other exonerees. The one that you're likeliest to know is the case of Walter McMillian, who was the subject of Bryan Stevenson's acclaimed book, Just Mercy. Here's Stevenson talking about his case.
The amazing thing was that at the time of the crime, he was actually raising money for his sister's church, and there were about 30 people of color with him, 11 miles from the crime scene. So they knew he was innocent. And when he was arrested, they went to the sheriff and said, "You've got the wrong man." They were ignored. The trial lasted a day and a half. He was convicted of capital murder. He was actually sentenced to life without parole by the jury. And the trial judge, whose name was Robert E. Lee Key, overrode the jury's verdict and imposed the death penalty. And he spent the next 6 years on death row. And when I started working on the case, they had convicted him based on the testimony of one man. I found out that this man had been coerced to testify falsely. He just admitted to me that it was all a lie. And then he told me that he had been recorded trying to persuade them that he shouldn't do this. And so we started looking and we found tapes where the police had interrogated this man while they were coercing him to testify falsely. And for some bizarre reason, they tape recorded those sessions. So the witness was actually on the tape saying, quote, "You want me to frame an innocent man for murder, and I don't feel right about that." And the police officer was saying, "Well, you better give us what we want, or we're going to put you on death row."
A second Alabama death row exoneree is Anthony Ray Hinton, who was convicted of a murder largely based upon a ballistics expert who testified that the bullets used in the murder came from his gun. 30 years after the jurors entered a non-unanimous verdict for the death sentence, that ballistics expert changed his tune. Here's Hinton describing what happened.
He come back and I quote to his exact words. He tested the bullets and he said, "The bullets do not match the way they matched 30 years ago, but they match exactly the way they did 30 years ago. Bullets is like fingerprint, they don't change. The state of Alabama was going to execute an innocent man and they knew it."
Other death row exonerees in Alabama include Daniel Wade Moore, who was released in a Brady violation after a judge overrode an 8-4 jury vote in favor of a life sentence, and Wesley Quick, who was convicted on a non-unanimous jury death vote despite strong evidence pointing in the direction of an alternate suspect. And then we have Randall Padgett, who was given the death penalty after being wrongfully convicted of the murder of his ex-wife and the jury voting 9-3 in favor of a life sentence. Here, Padgett describes his physical reaction to the judge's override.
"The judge overrode the life without that the jury recommended and sentenced me to the electric chair."
"And what was that like?"
"It was like a nightmare. It felt like being in a whole different planet. You know, I don't know how to explain it, but it was terrible.
When I spoke with Rocky, he described a similar reaction when the judge overrode the jury's 9-3 vote in favor of a life sentence.
I remember this, though. I remember the hurtiest thing that ever happened to me. The guilty part, you know, didn't hurt me as much as when the judge said that I was a threat to society. You know, well, you know, because he overrode the jury. And he overrode the jury for me to be executed. But he told me that I was a threat to society, you know, that I couldn't be trusted, that I'd get out and start killing everybody. And I'm like, that's so far from the truth. It's pathetic, you know. Mm-hmm. And that really, really hurt me. It hurt my feelings. It did. Because you know that, you know, it's like somebody said you've done something and you know you didn't do it. You know what I'm saying? And it hurts you, especially if it's somebody like you love, or somebody, your child or your wife or something like that. Even though that judge wasn't on that level, but still the words was like needles, swords, knives going through. You know,
right.
I remember that was horrible.
Now, we've been talking about judicial override in the context of residual doubt in the theoretical sense, with that theory being, it's likely that jurors vote for life sentences in capital cases in which they harbor some doubt about the defendant's guilt. But it turns out that it's not just theoretical. Patrick Mulvaney and his team at the Southern Center for Human Rights spoke with the jurors from some of these Alabama cases.
We went and talked to some of the jurors from those cases, and their experiences really line up with this concern about residual doubt. Jurors from several of those cases said, we voted for life at the penalty phase, because we had some doubts about the defendant's guilt. And then the judge overrode the jury and imposed the death penalty. And years later, we find out that those individuals were wrongfully convicted.
So did some jurors in the Rocky Myers case also hold residual doubts? Well, it goes well beyond that. Some jurors in the Rocky Myers case were convinced he was innocent. Here's juror May Puckett.
And he is an innocent man. And it's very important to me. There's not a day that goes by that I don't think about this man. And I think back during the trial and during deliberations. If there was something that we could have done differently, and there wasn't, our hands were tied. We only had certain decisions we could make, and we did the best we could do. But we could not change what the judge did. I remember this man every day. Every day I wake up and I think about him at some time during the day. It sneaks into my mind and it's hard. It's a burden on my heart.
So what does Puckett mean about their choices being limited? Well, she says that the jury selection didn't start well and things didn't improve once the trial started.
One man, I forget what the question was, but his answer to Bob Burrell was, I feel like if a man has made it through the grand jury and to trial that he's guilty. And he made the cut for the jury. So at that point, in my mind, I thought, how are we ever going to be able to make a fair decision if it couldn't work. If one person already went in thinking, I'm going to vote that he's guilty no matter what. And I don't know how he got in that cut, but he did. So I had concerns already going into deliberations. And even before we got that far, several times during the trial, the man sitting next to me was sleeping several times. I would have to nod and wake him up, and no one, you know, acted like it was a big deal, you know, but I'd nudge him, and a couple of times the bailiffs prompted me, and the other jurors, you know, they would get someone's attention and they'd go down the line and get me to elbow him and wake him up, and he'd, you know, wake up.
Nonetheless, Puckett listened closely to the evidence, and it left her without any belief that Rocky Myers had killed Looney Mae Tucker.
I don't feel like the state ever proved he did anything. The only connection that I can remember is that he had the VCR, and his story, I mean, it was believable how he got the VCR because of his way of life. That did not connect him with the murder. And there was one of the jurors in there, they kept saying over and over, rabbit tracks, you know, just look at the rabbit tracks. That's what he was using to refer to the VCR connected with Rocky Myers. And it just, you know, that didn't make any sense. If somebody's going to find something in the bushes and sell it, that doesn't mean they killed someone, you know.
And Puckett wasn't alone. There were other jurors who thought Rocky was innocent, including the one African-American on the jury.
I remember the one black man, I remember him because he cried. And he was, he and I were one of the last ones to vote guilty.
Of course, this may leave you wondering how these jurors ended up finding Rocky Myers guilty, if they believed him to be innocent. According to Puckett, there were two reasons. The first was the bailiff.
The struggle was going on back there with us in deliberations, and we were kind of feeling pressure. The bailiff kind of talked to the head lady, the foreman, let her know that we needed to hurry up. I don't know what was said, but the foreman let us know that, you know, we need to hurry up. You know, they're waiting on us. They're tired. We need to make a decision.
And if you're wondering, no, this isn't proper. And if the foreperson or any of the jurors had reported what the bailiff had done, it would have been grounds for a mistrial. And speaking of grounds for mistrial, we have the second reason that the innocent-leaning jurors decide to vote guilty.
Our hands were tied because... And this was actually a discussion with the jury back there in deliberations. We had, in our minds, we played out the scenarios. An innocent vote was, or not guilty vote, was out of the question. It was not going to happen with the people that was back there, and we knew that. And a guilty vote could go two ways. If we voted guilty, we could recommend the death penalty. Or we could vote guilty and recommend life in prison. And we kind of negotiated. We negotiated for him to go to prison for life. And we felt like, or I can only say for myself, I felt like that was the only way to do it. Because if we had a mistrial, and this was discussed too, if he had a mistrial, he could get a jury that just found him guilty, and it would just be the death penalty, you know. And the reason I felt so strongly about him having life in prison was because of his children. I could tell during testimony, hearing from his wife and his kids, I think it was just the one son. But I had children of my own. And just to try to imagine being separated from them and not having the influence on them that you needed to help them grow and be healthy and to be able to survive in life. And I felt like if we could allow him that opportunity to be a father and have communication with his children, at least we could have done something good from that trial, because that's the only good that was going to come from it.
That's what's known as a compromise verdict, and it's not supposed to happen. Indeed, if the attorneys had done what's known as a post-verdict voir dire, and a juror had mentioned their compromise verdict, a mistrial would have been declared. But now, years later, nothing can be done. For Mae Puckett, this is devastating.
And to find out later that the judge had changed it, I was devastated. I had already told my family that I don't want to know anything else about it. If he's in the news, if his date comes up, I don't want to know anything about it. And I had thought that things had already happened because it had been so many years and I hadn't heard anything. So I thought, well, they did a good job. My family did a good job of keeping that from me. But now I know that nothing, they had been forgotten about. It had just been cast aside and forgotten about.
Rocky Myers isn't the only Alabama death row inmate to be cast aside. We noted earlier that Delaware and Florida, the only other states that had judicial override, got rid of their procedures after the Supreme Court's opinion in Hearst, with Delaware clearing all override inmates from death row and only 5 override inmates remaining in Florida after many were given resentencing. Like these states, Alabama also eliminated judicial override after Hearst, but it didn't apply this law retroactively, meaning there are dozens of men on Alabama's death row based upon a procedure that no longer exists. And while Alabama did get rid of judicial override, it still allows for the death penalty based upon jury votes of 11-1 or 10-2 in favor of death, which was the vote in the Anthony Ray Hinton case. Alabama is now the only state that allows for non-unanimous jury votes, although there are 2 other states with quirky procedures. I'm currently working with some Alabama representatives on changing this law, and we're hopeful it'll be successful in the next year or two. But where does this leave Rocky Myers? Well, several Alabama inmates with judicial override death sentences have brought constitutional challenges to their sentences. Some are based upon the Supreme Court's ruling in Hearst, but those might be a tough sell because of the odd nature of Florida's old procedure. The other challenge, however, sounds more promising.
There's another issue, which I think was one of the reasons why the Alabama legislature ultimately did away with judicial override, and that is an Eighth Amendment argument. The Eighth Amendment prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, but the United States Supreme Court has said that in determining whether a punishment is cruel and unusual punishment, you look to the evolving standards of decency in U.S. society, and that is measured first by legislative judgments about what an appropriate process is, and then there are a series of other factors that you take a look at. When you apply the evolving standards analysis to judicial override, you see that there was only one state left that allowed it. And the U.S. Supreme Court has declared a number of practices in the death penalty to be unconstitutional when there were, in some instances, 20 states still allowed it, but in most instances, around 2 or 3 states that still allowed it.
Facially, this seems like a compelling argument, but it might actually not be the strongest argument for taking Rocky Myers off of death row. That reason is a reason that has been compared to judicial override as a reason to believe that a death row inmate is innocent, and it's a reason that almost certainly applies to Rocky Myers. But it's also a reason that Rocky has never fully been able to raise in court because he was abandoned by his appellate counsel. Next time on Undisclosed.
A big thank you to everybody who makes Undisclosed possible. Thank you to our sponsors who help us put on our episodes week after week. Thank you to Mital Delahan, our executive producer, for helping keep this ship afloat. Thank you to Rebecca Lavoie, our fantastic audio producer, and also the co-host and producer of a couple of my favorite podcasts, including Crime Writers On. Do not miss her podcast. Thank you to Baluki for our logo, to Christy for maintaining our website. Also, a big thank you to our listeners. Thanks for coming back week after week. Check us out and make sure to follow us online on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle is @UndisclosedPod. And please do not forget to subscribe to us on iTunes and rate us. Thanks so much. See you in a week.